Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. As we head to the end of 2011, we thought it only appropriate to take stock of the first 10 episodes of Section D and pick out our favourite bits. This is our best of the best, a whiz through the last few months of design and architecture around the world. Coming up, we hear again from a few of our favourite voices, including the gravelly wisdom of Terence Conran.
You know, I've always had the ambition to make home furnishings that anybody can buy, you know, rather than a small, you know, the Conran shop is a small market, it doesn't reach out.
We revisit the wilds of Finland to hear how the country's oldest company still makes the cut.
Have you been to a scissors factory before?
No, never.
No.
It's the first time for everything.
Yeah.
And our photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, tells us her feelings about our feathered friends.
It was a bright and sunny summer morning at 8:45 when an unfortunate and scared pigeon flew into my kitchen window.
That, plus a whole lot more, is all to come later in the show. It's a whistle-stop journey around the world, so fasten your seatbelts and sit tight. We're off to Japan in a few moments. Welcome to the best of the best of Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. One of our founding principles with Section D was to talk about design in human terms, not lofty academic musings, but getting real people to talk about real things, what they mean to them and how they use them. Nobody did this better than Sam Hecht of Industrial Facility, who in episode 4 of Section D spoke to me about his particular relationship with Japanese design.
These pots, which we've had for a long time. Pans and pots, yeah. They're by a designer called Sori Yanagi.
Of course.
Who is an interesting guy. I mean, I didn't know a lot about him when I studied design, but when I started to work and also when I lived in Japan, they had this amazing exhibition of his work. It was in a department store. And that's something very unique about Japan is that their department stores, in fact, the whole idea about consumption is as much a kind of a cultural endeavour as it is a need or a desire. So you can be walking through department stores and you can come across these kind of small exhibitions, and it might be about a particular craft or craftsman or designer, or without you realising it, you are kind of being educated in some ways.
But that's so fantastic. I mean, Sori Yanagi is obviously one of the masters of Japanese design from the 20th century.
Yeah.
But he's really sunk into the minds of sort of everyday Japanese people, not just the design industry, do you think?
Certainly his work is you do see it in a lot of places, and it has kind of melted into a lot of Japan.
And is that because his things are sort of the essence of function? Don't have to be a design connoisseur to appreciate how his pans are made. They just work
possibly
very well.
Because they're very thin stainless steel, beautifully made, in the sense that they're not expensive, but they are put together very, very well. You know, you can't see the kind of the weld lines or anything. And it's a very simple idea. It's a pan that is kind of has an asymmetrical shape, and what he's done is he's kind of morphed two spouts on the pan, but they don't look like spouts. They allow you to pour, and then you have a lid which matches it. But the great thing about it is that as you're boiling something, you just have to turn the lid, and that allows the steam to come out without having to adjust it or move it.
So you precariously balance the lid on a spoon or anything?
Yeah. So it's... And I think this is an amazing thing about Yanagi. In fact, amazing thing about Japan in general is that they have this great ability to be able to think about function or action where there's almost like different sets of actions, but within one product.
Maybe if we go upstairs. I just wanted we talked earlier about Toki Hands.
Yeah.
And in our office we drink from Toki Hands mugs.
Brilliant.
And what's amazing is, of course, it's a huge mug.
which is clearly meant for naive tourists like me to buy it and then bring it back. And I've never seen one with such a big mug in
Japan. But you've been sucked in.
Yeah, but to try and put, I mean, the reason to show it is that, I mean, it's very, very hard to describe what Tokyo Hands is to someone who hasn't been there. But if I could try, it's essentially almost like a pilgrimage to consumption. It's a place where, on one level, anything in your life that has frustrated you, it will solve. If there's a particular shoelace that you can't get anywhere, and it really annoys you, you will find it there. Oh yeah, I mean, I should actually explain that it is a department store. I don't quite know what shopping once was, say 50 years ago, but I could imagine that perhaps it once was like this, where there was a feeling of education, where people were demonstrating things in front of you. Those elements have kind of been lost a bit. And now they've been replaced with kind of pure materialism, which is all about desire. And Tokyo Hands is much more than that.
There's something very primeval about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, you mentioned spending days there, which sounds like an exaggeration, but I totally relate to that, because I went for an hour in my first time to Tokyo, thinking, oh, you know, everybody talks about it, I've got to go and see. And I ended up spending about 6 hours there. And just the sheer range, but actually more than what was on sale, it was watching how Japanese people were buying and how they were looking for things. And that was, I think I probably learned more about Japanese approach to consumerism and design
from
those 6 hours than I did for the rest of the 10 days that I spent in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it definitely, Tokyo Hands is not the kind of place where you can do a pop-in.
No.
I mean, you can go in 5 minutes and...
I mean, no, you can maybe pop in to restock your mugs, but that's about it.
Yeah.
That was Sam Hecht in his London studio with me. Now, one of the highlights of my year was sitting down with Terence Conran for episode 5 to hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak, about his life and work at his 80th birthday.
I mean, the way we live now is very different to the way we lived in the 60s.
Oh, it certainly is totally and completely different. Life in the 50s, which was when I really started, was execrable. I think that's the right word for it. You couldn't buy any modern furniture then. Well, I suppose you could if you went to extreme lengths to try and find it. If you went to Denmark, you could find modern furniture then. It was very much a Fabian thing, I think, a taste in modernity.
As you grew up, did you think actually this furniture and the sensibility that goes into making something very simple and functional has a much wider possibility for...
Yeah, I've always made things. My parents gave me a workshop at our house in the country, and I had welding equipment and a lathe and did a lot of metalworking, woodworking, made things. I even had a pottery wheel and a wood-fired kiln in the garden.
And do you consider yourself first and foremost a designer then?
Yes, a design entrepreneur, I suppose.
I know various people try and pigeonhole you as a businessman beyond a designer, but I don't feel that you like being described as that.
No, I certainly would hate to be called just a businessman, but you know, I have always recognised that you have to have a successful business to make things happen. And I really enjoy making things happen.
Habitat is something that most people associate with you.
I know.
And...
dead and gone in the UK, but alive and well in the continent.
Which is extraordinary and quite sad.
Very, very sad indeed. However, we have Marks and Spencer's project as the alternative. And, you know, to work with Marks and Spencer's, it's been my dream all my working life.
Why is that?
Well, it's the democracy that it goes out to the whole nation. rich or poor. You know, it's available everywhere and all over the place. And, you know, I've always had the ambition to make home furnishings that anybody can buy. You know, the Conran shop is a small market. It doesn't reach out east, west, south and north.
Do you have any regrets when you look back? Do you wish maybe that you'd held on to Habitat?
Or? Yes, I do wish I'd held on to Habitat, because Habitat could have been what IKEA now is. And it's bizarre that IKEA bought it and let it collapse.
You have a great knack for instinct. It's not the way that businesses are necessarily run nowadays. And that tends to be for the worse.
Somebody asked me the question, when was I going to retire? And I said I had no intention of ever retiring. I'll hope I'll die with unfinished projects, because my work is my hobby. Some people have yachts in the Mediterranean and play golf. I don't. Everything I do in my life, even down to my gardening side, is productive. And somebody the other day said to me about my house in the country, which has got the old farm buildings attached, converted to Benchmark, this woodworking, furniture making factory that I run there, which has got about 50 people working in it. They said, why do you want to have a factory in your garden? I said, I love it. You know, it's productive. It employs people. And I get the greatest pleasure from designing something on a Sunday, making a model of it on Monday and Tuesday, and seeing by Friday a working prototype, just, you know, is really fulfilling.
What do you hope that 100 years from now people remember Sir Terence Conran for?
Oh gosh, I hope they will see me as a designer who made things that were plain, simple and useful in a world that has got terribly overcomplicated, and that, you know, that my life had allowed people to furnish their homes and their workplaces in a more relaxed and easy way, that there wasn't anything pretentious about my philosophy.
That was Terence Conran with me in episode 5 of Section D.
Monocle is strapping on its skis, pulling on its mittens, and heading to the mountains for the launch of our winter resort paper, Monocle Alpino. This large form of paper takes you to the snowy highs of Slovenia and Sochi and discovers a little piece of Italy marooned in Switzerland. It also offers glowing reeds, homes to encourage you to build an alpine roost, hearty recipes, and puffed-up cozy fashions for heading out in a snow flurry. We also go on rescue missions in Iceland and find the ultimate mountain cinemas and newspapers. Monocle Alpino is on sale now, and it's the perfect companion for a fireside moment. Tack!
Welcome back to the best of Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. For the very first Section D, I flew up to Finland to see the birthplace of the country's oldest company, Fiskars.
Fiskars was established in 1649 in the same surroundings, doing ironworks, and we have been doing it ever since. I think the turnover is currently something like 700 something million for the whole corporation, and we operate globally. We have our own offices in certain countries, and then we do a lot of export. We divide our business into three areas, which is home, garden and outdoors.
The factory is in a small town called Billnäs. It's hard to believe, pulling up to the doors, that each of the Fiskars scissors in global circulation has such an unassuming birthplace. But it's so very Finnish, too. Something the Finns do so well is meticulous, everyday design. And something they understand better than most is the importance of keeping manufacturing on home turf. It's a way of safeguarding the core of the brand. Each pair of scissors is stamped with Stainless Finland on them. And touring the factory with the head of scissors product development, Heikki Saivalainen, it's clear this company would lose its soul if manufacturing would be outsourced.
It's quite nice that the people who work here, they are pretty much from this area, from Tammisaari or Karja or but pretty much from this area. And it's funny to discuss with people here, because if you discuss with a lady who is 60, she can tell you that, okay, my daughter is also working, but it's like several generations have been working on the same factory, and it's nice to discuss with people. My mom used to work there, my mom used to do that product and so on.
So it's a very strong part of the community in the local area.
Yeah.
And do you train people in the factory then for all the different things?
Yes. And I think something that we do here is something special, and we want to keep it inside. And not, of course, the people have different backgrounds, and we appreciate that a lot. But then on top of, we want to teach them the Fiskars certain processes that we do here only inside. So.
These company community towns are scarce in Europe, and it's not just a nostalgic notion that local manufacturing is good. Companies such as Fiskars are the beating heart of the local community, socially and economically.
Have you been to a scissors factory before?
No, never.
No.
It's the first time for everything.
Yeah. There's not so many scissors factories in Europe anymore. Production is pretty much in Far East nowadays.
But it still makes sense for Fiskars to manufacture in Finland.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think it makes sense because we are keeping the product alive and have something special compared to the Far East products.
And it's such a Finnish brand as well.
It makes sense. It really makes sense. And it would be a shame that it would change over to outsource production.
As Finland's oldest company, Fiskars has a long history and one its employees wear with pride. In the mid-19th century, the Fiskars plough was the first product to be patented in Finland. In the mid-1960s, Fiskars was one of the first European companies to make microwaves. But it's the scissors that are the brand's calling card.
First, this is a pair of scissors from late 19th century. And actually, when you take the newest orange-handled scissors, these two are quite alike. They have the same ergonomic handle shapes. Once you look at the scissor, it looks like, as Siru said, it looks like really simple product, but then going into details, it's not a product where you actually combine two knives. It's more than that. What makes it so different is that in the late 19th century, the pair of scissors like this cost like a month's salary for a tailor. But then in 1967, when the orange-handled scissors was launched, the price for normal consumer was only like 1 hour's salary. So everybody can actually afford that pair of scissors at that time. So that was very big.
That was me and Fiskars getting to know kitchen scissors. Escaping from the onset of winter in Western Europe, we flew to Miami in early December to hear how the city's annual design fair, Design Miami, was faring in this difficult economic climate.
The first design you notice at Design Miami is actually outside the exhibition tent. It's a 10-foot wooden cube with an egg-shaped space resected from the box, creating oval portals that open to the bright blue Miami sky. This is Genesis, the site-specific installation by designer of the year David Ajay. Ajay is a London-based architect who was born in Tanzania. Before they even go inside the exhibition space, visitors to Design Miami climb and lean and sit on Ajay's Genesis installation. It's interactive, complicated, simultaneously organic and mathematical, exquisitely executed. Genesis sets the tone for Design Miami.
I think it's the only fair dedicated to collectible design, meaning to very rare objects of the past or experimental design fresh out of the laboratories of today.
Marianne Goebel is director of Design Miami. Design Miami is in its seventh year, 50% bigger than it was last year, with nearly 30 galleries showing collections inside the tent that we now sit in. This is the second year Design Miami's been on Miami Beach, directly across the street from its sister fair, Art Basel.
If you are already a design expert or you're a design virgin, you can really discover very interesting and beautiful and compelling things. so you can learn and you can simply have a good time.
Mariana Rodriguez Iglesias is one of those visitors having a very good time.
And I think this is art nowadays.
She's just walked through a performance exhibit sponsored by Fendi. Using scrap leather, artists Elisa Strozek and Sebastian Nieb have been constructing strange, sagging pieces of furniture.
Como sueños, es magia, ¿no? Es un sueño o surrealismo.
Like dreams, Rodriguez Iglesias says, magic, surrealism. Rodriguez Iglesias is a curator from Buenos Aires, Argentina. She says she found Art Basel across the street to be colder than she expected, more commercial. Here it's more moderate, more thoughtful. There's order. One of those expertly ordered spaces at Design Miami is Gallery Seomi from Korea. The organic designs and materials here have a decidedly marine feel. A walnut wood bench from Sewa Bay is steam-bent into the undulating lines of a wave about to crest. Then there are Hunchung Lee's ceramic stools, like oversized coral polyps with ocean turquoise glazes. Gallerist PJ Park and I sit down on two of those stools and talk about what Design Miami means to Korean designers.
Korea, in a way, has lost or never had a contemporary design scene. After the war in the 50s, everything was torn down, and then mostly it was imported. So what you see here are contemporary Korean designers who are actually believing that Korean contemporary design is very important, and that it's something that we need in our history.
Park, who is drinking a small cup of Cuban coffee, says he thinks about place when preparing for Design Miami.
Because we're in Miami, I bring what I think will fit into Miami. Of course, the weather is so nice. It's always sun. So we bring outdoor furniture and designs.
Park is not the only one thinking about light. Light is definitely a focus of this year's show.
Lighting is the one thing that we find the least of and sell the most of.
Evan Snyderman of our 20th Century Gallery says this as he sits underneath three light sculptures by Jeff Zimmerman. The lights defy gravity the way they grow out of the ceiling and wall, like the reaching tendrils of vines.
The lighting has so much influence on everything around it. There's no other piece of furniture that does that.
Then there's the light installation by Random International at Carpenter's Workshop Gallery. It's a panel of square, mirrored light bulbs that glow in an amoeba-like outline of the person standing before it. The effect is sort of a reverse silhouette. Gallerist Loic Legaillard of Carpenter's Workshop.
Contemporary designer will work with the mediums and the techniques of their generation, and interaction is of course something which is extremely contemporary.
Like other gallerists this week, Legaillard says business is good.
The Museum of Art and Design in New York has actually purchased this Double Buffet Nouvelle-Zélande from Vincent Dubourg.
As much as Design Miami is a showcase for global designers, it also functions as a space for hobnobbing and catching up. Glasses of champagne are as fashionable as black pants around here. The scent of perfume and alcohol swirls through the crowds.
People are definitely laid back. It's different than Switzerland.
Paul Johnson of Johnson Trading Gallery.
We're showing Guangguo Li, Max Lam, Ricky Clifton, and Rafael de Cardenas. They're all very different designers, but they kind of have the same kind of language because everything's kind of made by hand.
He says he likes what he's seen here so far this year.
Some of the American galleries here are showing like Frank Lloyd Wright, and the show's never had that. It's been like highly European vintage.
Aside from Frank Lloyd Wright, some of the vintage pieces getting noticed here are Privé tables and Ron Arad's concrete stereo. But not everyone at Design Miami is sold on the vintage contemporary designs. Over at Moss Gallery, a crowd gathers around a series of white, laser-cut steel bowls. They look like magnified tissue samples. A sign on the wall describes artist and Dr. Haresh Lalvani as a morphologist. I ask gallerist Franklin Getchell to explain.
What is a morphologist? A morphologist, I think anyone can be a morphologist. It's, you are a morphologist, aren't you?
What makes me a morphologist?
Saying you are one. No, it's a term I think that Haresh uses to describe his work because he is focused so much on the changing.
On the subject of change, Getchell, who has been coming to Design Miami since Design Miami was new, says the fair has evolved.
This fair used to be about contemporary design, which was quite interesting. and groundbreaking. And so now coming here is coming to a totally different kind of fair for us. It's not that it's a bad fair, it's just not what it was when we started coming. We liked it the way it was, and they should have left it alone. But
says the man who's showing the morphology exhibit.
So, oh yeah, good point.
One of the designers bringing new techniques to the fair this year is Tom Price. His Meltdown series for Industry Gallery is a set of chairs made from plastic objects. This is Price's first time at Design Miami. He says he's impressed by what he's seen. He's also been impressed by the weather.
It's great. Hey, I've just come from London, and it's about 1 degree, and it's cold, and it's raining, and it's windy, and I just strolled down Miami Beach to work today, and it's not a bad place to be.
Back outside the tent, it's turned into an only in Miami kind of night. The air is salty, with just a whisper of a breeze coming off the ocean. Ajay's wooden Genesis sculpture smells like a timber yard. One of the visitors sitting on the edge of the box is Columbia-born Miami architect Claudia Ospina. For Ospina, the best contemporary design is a self-fulfilling achievement.
If you believe in what you design, it's always going to be there, no matter how hard times are. And whoever appreciates art, they're always going to recognize what is valuable and what is worth it. And when it comes to art, nobody stops art, because art is infinite. It won't stop.
By those standards, Design Miami has a bright future.
That was our reporter Sammy Mack at Design Miami for Episode 8 of Section D. And from one fair to another, though in a slightly less glamorous location, our reporter Thea Urdel headed to East Dulwich in South London to hear why the mid-century modern furniture show is so enduringly popular.
Twice a year, design lovers flock to a lovely Victorian boarding school in South London to attend the Mid-Century Design Fair at Dulwich College. Now in its 10th year, the fair is recognised as the mother of all destinations for 20th century design classics and modern collectibles. The autumn edition just took place last weekend, and Monocle donned woolen scarves and ventured into the foggy weather to find the reason why mid-century design seemingly never goes out of style. Lucy Ryder Richardson, who initiated the fair with Petra Curtis in 2002, talks us through the history of the event.
Well, we started as with a little photocopy. Petra had drawn a chair on it, and amazingly enough, we got 500 people the first show, which we were quite shocked about. And then at that stage, we only had about 20 designers and 30 dealers, I think. Might have even been a bit less than that. And now we have 3,000 people coming in 6 hours, and we have 95 dealers and designers twice a year at Dulwich College. And we also have a mid-century show now twice a year at Lord's Cricket Ground, which we're really, really excited about.
Mid-century design will for many always be synonymous with the likes of Arne Jacobsen and Hans Jørg Wegner. Sarah Potter of the eponymous design firm Sarah Potter elaborates on the everlasting Danish appeal.
We're living in ever-decreasing spaces, and the lines are very sharp. Very often the furniture is very adaptive. You can get a table which will go from a coffee table into a dining table into a console table, and I think it's very flexible, and again, based on price, it'll be hard to beat at the moment.
Mid-century modern has a cult following, but apart from eyeing the Eames rocker, what items should we be buying at the moment?
My name's Saxon Durrant. I'm the owner of Metro Retro. Always popular are industrial artifacts, things from old factories, stools, benches, lockers, workbenches, anything that's old and characterful. People are starting to buy things that look a bit more beaten up nowadays, where they used to want things absolutely spit and polished, looking totally perfect. Now they're not quite so worried. They want to see the character and the age in things a bit more now. People are always looking for good storage. That's what really sells. Things that solve a problem. And if you can solve that problem using something that's vintage and got a bit of character to it, rather than something that's worthless as soon as it's taken out the shop door, then that's all for the good.
It's really important for us for it to be a place that anybody can come to. The public doesn't feel intimidated by it. Having said that, we seem to get a ridiculous amount of incredible furniture designers like Matthew Hilton and Russell Pinch, and we get artists, Mike Nelson, Dinos Chapman's been before. So it's very exciting to get all these people who know a lot about design. Ola Keeley's one of our biggest fans. Sheridan Coakley popped in last year. I haven't seen him this time, but it's really exciting from having not tried too hard to get these people for free, that they actually just turn up because they've heard about it and they're excited about it, and it's something they can do on their Sunday. We're not throwing so much stuff in skips anymore. We really, really don't want to have to spend all our money at IKEA, and we don't necessarily have the money to go somewhere where we spend a lot of money on very expensive modern designers. You know, it loses value, you know, like a new car. Unless it's a really iconic piece, it could possibly lose value. So I think you know pretty well that none of this will go down in value unless your kids ruin it. So it's a pretty safe bet to buy mid-century furniture. I love people like Bruno Mathisson and Arne Jacobsen and George Nelson. But I think a lot of people who come to our shows, like the architects, buy really quirky pieces. They're looking for something a little bit different. Hans Wegner is one of my favourite people. I love Tapio Virkola's ceramics. He's a Finnish designer, amazing ceramics. It's just all a matter of taste.
That was Teja Erdl, roaming the stands of the Mid-Century Modern Furniture Fair in East Dulwich for Section D, Episode 7.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to the best of Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. One of our favourite discoveries was the keen eye and sharp tongue of Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, who regularly penned a monologue of her design observations from the magazine. Our favourite came in episode 7 of Section D, where Poppy mused on her fear of birds.
It was a bright and sunny summer morning at 8:45 when an unfortunate and scared pigeon flew into my kitchen window all of a sudden. With a loud crash and with much broken glass, it landed and died on our floor. Boom. I've had a bird phobia since this avian attack. Not just a phobia of birds flying through windows onto our lovely shiny kitchen floor, but also pronouncing the word bird. I have to concentrate really hard to get the sound out of my Japanese mouth. We have three birds pictures in the December and January issue of Monocle magazine. It was unavoidable given the sheer volume of this issue. One wooden retro duck by Hans Bolling, one black Eames house bird, and the third one is L'Oiseau by Brulec Brothers, designed for Vitra. This French L'Oiseau is made of a beautiful cream-coloured maple wood, shaped and sanded to a smooth finish, with no varnish or polish. It's minimally sculptural and simply shaped, just enough to communicate the idea that this is a bird, and draws my imagination into thinking which type of bird this actually is. It's curvy looking from the front with a plump chest, with the fine lines gathered towards its little pointy closed beak. From the side, the body is simplified and is streamlined like a golf putter. I can imagine that this bird could probably swim in the water too. The shadow that is cast by the bird's elegant beak makes it look lean in profile, and its tail lifts upwards charmingly. The body shows different cuts of maple wood grain too. He looks very classy, yet familiar, and feels like an artifact that could be found in a village within a rich folk art history. This sophisticated wingless French bird might be able to make me forget about the terrible invasion that occurred one fateful summer morning. Our design editor Hugo tells me that having a bird object in the house will protect me from unwelcome intruders. So maybe I should get a wooden bird to scare off its real-life feathered friends. That way I won't have to suffer nightmares directed by Alfred Hitchcock anymore. This is Poppy Shibamoto from Monocle's Picture Desk.
Over the last 10 episodes, I've had the fortune to sit down with some of the design world's greatest characters. One of the more bizarre experiences was for Section D Episode 2, when I headed to luxury retail architect Peter Marino's hotel bedroom. The leather-clad guru told me about the future of retail design.
There are two departments I just visited this week who really do make you feel like department stores are coming back. And I can't say the same in New York.
Right.
And the one in Paris is Printemps.
Yeah.
Boy.
Looks good.
Looks great. Yeah. They're spending real money to fix it up. Mm. And I was very impressed because there is, and I can really say this factory, there is no department store making that kind of investment in the US at the moment.
What about the big Barney's overhaul? What do you make of that?
What's the height? How much space is left under the stomach of a pregnant aunt?
Because you kind of started your career at Barney's,
yeah,
didn't
you? Yeah, so they just, you know, it's just the brands. That's all, in America, it's all what I call eyewash. It's, you know, eyewash, as opposed to a real investment. And Pratt's all gilding their roofs and redoing the ancient mosaics that hadn't been redone in 160 years. I mean, they're really fixing it up. That's an Italian, it belongs to an Italian corporation. And then here, you've got to say, you've got Selfridges in London. And it's kind of interesting. So I had a sort of like, I'm very down in New York on Saks and Bloomingdale's, which for me as a kid growing up, were traditionally absolutely gorgeous shops. And I think Bloomingdale's is just a zoo. And Saks has just got no direction. Every floor is different. They renovated. I mean, it's just like a rudder, you know, a directionless.
A mess.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess. Mm. So I come here to Europe and I feel there's a little bit more. And it may just have to do with the fact that those are both private investment groups, the two that I've cited, and the large ones who are on the stock exchange are sort of hemorrhaging. I don't know if the customers notice it. I notice it as a professional architect. Where would you rather shop for a Chanel dress? In Bloomingdale's or at Chanel?
Chanel, yeah.
First, they care more. Exactly. Something happens to the product. I mean, you go to Bloomingdale's, I'm sorry, you never even see the same salesperson twice.
Do you notice that the luxury fashion houses are looking for something different?
The last few years, the luxury houses, and I work for about 8 of them, have all turned their view towards China and their capex, what they call the capital, you know, capital spending allowances, have all been directed towards China, where growth rates in retail sales are regularly 11 to 20%. We can't touch that in the US, where the growth rates are barely flat, and it's the same in Europe. So the investments of all luxury, because they have their capital allowances, and the proportion, what I'm telling you, 11 to 21%, is so high that it gives them enough cash to keep going on. It's an enormous growth in what had been a very underdeveloped market.
And what's your experience of working in China like?
Every time you go to Shanghai, you don't even recognize it 6 months later. It's so rapid.
Yeah.
I have to say, for an architect, it actually gives you hope.
Do you
because
think?
Yeah, because all of Europe and now New York and the cities and blah, 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 okay, and our charming little Western society, everybody landmarks everything, including a garage and a door, and you've got to get a city council to paint your window trim. I think it's so overdone. And you go to a city like there, you know what? You feel alive, you feel vibrant, you feel like, I want to design something, I'm going to have a chance. One of the largest projects in our office is a new Louis Vuitton in Shanghai. Now, I've already built 3 Louis Vuittons in Shanghai. But, of course, having said that, Shanghai has 26 million people. So they go 3 shops, 1 for every 8 million. It's not a lot. It's going to be about double the size of the one I did on the Champs-Élysées in Paris.
No way.
And that's already 4 floors. That's all I can tell you.
My God.
That's how I just...
It's insane.
Insane.
I can't even imagine what that would feel like to be in.
How about try designing it?
Do you design a project thinking 50 years from now this is
depends
still going to be
if you're
here?
Talking about the exterior architecture or the interior. It is assumed that the interior architecture will not last.
Beyond how long?
A 7-year period of...
7 years?
Yeah. It is assumed that that will not last.
And do you think the customers or the clientele, as you say, do you think they really notice? Does it have an effect on the way that people shop?
I think it's very subliminal. I'm always surprised at how much they do notice. Luxury shops have 2 type of customers that I find in the world today where they really count it. A really very high level of clientele who know exactly what's going on. And he'll say to me, "Oh God, I love those curtains you did for Dior in Geneva. And the other one I really like is the one you did in New York." And I'm going, "God, I mean, even I don't..." I said, "What?" You know, and then they'll show me on their iPhone the photos. And I go, "Oh yeah, those were good, lovey." I always forget the extent to which well-heeled people travel and shop around the world. And the other kind of client is a less well-heeled, less traveled local client who isn't really going to see everything, but they notice the places too very, very well. And then you got number three, you got the tourists. And tourists in luxury brands have to account for probably 20-30% of sales. That's a very, very, very big number. They got to know everything subliminally because they're on a 7-day junket. They're going to do 30 shops. They got to remember us. So you got a lot of sometimes seemingly conflicting goals here. At the Shanghai return is so high, they're saying you will probably get between 2.5 and 3 million visitors, or what they're called, per year. And I was like, what? You know, like, how do you do that with carpets that are luxurious, with woods that aren't going to get completely crapped up, and beautiful paint finishes and art? And how do you do anything? It's a new, for me, it's a little bit of a new set of rules. And I have to say, I'm struggling with it. I mean, how do you do high-volume luxury? I always thought high-volume was, the Gap or Coach or something. I thought that's what high-volume was. It doesn't seem like an oxymoron, high-volume luxury. Absolutely. And I go, huh? Yeah. But it is.
That was Peter Marino and me in his hotel bedroom for episode 2 of Section D. And from one charismatic Peter to another, I was joined in the studio for episode 5 by Peter York. He gave his take on the influence of Terence Conran in a wonderfully lyrical way that only he could.
I wrote something about Conranism way back, and I had to dig deep and research how people reacted to the first famous bit of Conranism. I mean, in fact, Conranism had been going on since the mid-50s when he was designing things and talking to Medialand about designing things, and you will see a lot about that. And then opening, as it were, soup kitchens for smart, more dash than cash people in the King's Road and so on. But the point at which he became important and focusing and really bigly famous was with the opening of Habitat, which was sort of, I'm trying to remember, I think 67. And at that point, you see all the people are saying, all the media commentators are saying, it was as if we died and gone to heaven, because their own taste, their own hard-fought, hard-won taste, all those things that they got in little ones and twos out of Provence or wherever, were in one shop, assembled as a lifestyle. At last, as they used to say, at last a shop for us. Imagine. In the preppy handbook, they say, last a book for us, Muffy. Well, at last a shop for us. And so the sort of string-along terraces of newly enfranchised sort of Camden Town, Primrose Hill, etc., newly enfranchised, newly gentrified, could find their taste ready. And that was a wonderful thing, because you just think about the reality that it must have been set against, the daily reality of what it... See Maples and Die. See Maples and Die. Maples was a very big sort of Tottenham Court Road furniture department store. And the world of mass furnishings, or even not mass furnishings, and what Harrods had to sell you in furniture terms was just as grim. So until then, there simply weren't shops like that. There was Heels, and they were importers of the Danish look, the Scandi look. That was about it for the whole country. That culture didn't exist outside little bits of London W1. That was completely it. And the idea that there might be a mini chain spreading that to the rest of the land was completely wonderful. And it coincided with a lot of people doing new occupations and a lot of people for the first time going into higher education. So it was, you know, it was brilliantly timed. By definition, there was a larger audience for that sort of thing. And there was a large dedicated media coverage because there were colour supplements. So the timing was absolutely right.
That was Peter York in the studio talking to me about Terence Conran for episode 5 of Section D.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Another of our regular segments has been visiting different cities around the world each week and talking to a key figure in the design industry about their patch. From Auckland to Sao Paulo, Warsaw to Paris, we've heard from some wonderful people and places. But Beirut, in episode 6, was our favourite.
The half-Lebanese, half-Georgian architect Grigory Gazzarelia has come up with an entirely new proposition for Beirut. In the former customs or quarantine area of the city, he's opened Smo Gallery, a new space devoted to design set amidst industrial warehouses, garages, and a discreet working-class neighbourhood. Why open a design gallery when you're also very busy with your main job, which is architect?
I think it's always... there's no time to open a gallery. I think, on the contrary, I think it's very adequate as a timing because people need to be entertained. We're fed up of all the whatever, the stress, the situation, the regional situation, the look. But I think people need to see other things, see that their lives goes on, see beautiful stuff happening, etc. I think it was the perfect timing.
An avid collector, Gazzarelli opened his gallery to show his own pieces, believing this was the only way to be taken seriously. But most importantly, he did it to showcase local Lebanese design.
When we opened, I started to introduce or to present my private collection that I've been gathering for years. But I'm much more interested now in the contemporary design, the international designer, and mostly the local one.
You just mentioned Lebanese designers. Can you tell us a little bit, how's the scene here? Who are your favorite designers in Lebanon? Is it a growing scene of designers?
Absolutely. I think they're very interesting. A lot of them study in the best schools in Europe and in the States. Unfortunately, when they come back, they don't have the same backing technologically. So we have to be very traditional in the way we build, not on the way we think. And that's what I think start to make the local design very interesting, because it's more the thoughts than just the material. I thought it was the negative part of the local design, but it tend to be, I think, the nice part of the local design, because we don't need local Zaha Hadid the pieces, and we don't need Philip Stark sort of. No, we need the locals. We need them to work with our heritage, our way of doing things, and do it differently.
So let's talk a little bit about the current exhibition, where you basically went to the Beirut flea market and you found all these legs of public benches.
Yeah.
And then you asked maybe a dozen local designers, but not only designers, photographers, all sorts of artists, to come up with a design using the feet of these benches.
The idea was, when I discovered those legs, I said, okay, I will use them for my own project, but obviously. But I was touched by what I felt looking at them, and a bench of a public garden portrays so many emotional things. I mean, the lovers, and the homeless who sleeps on it, the old guy who rethinks about it. His whole life, and the spies that exchange the documents, and etc. But I cannot tell, or I didn't want to tell myself all the stories, so I said I will tell my friends and from different walk of life, whatever artist or etc., if they have an idea, what is those bench legs portrayed for them. And I gave to 16 different person, and it's amazing to see how 16 different minds go in all over the places, and this is what's great about the show.
Gattarello's emotional link to design has not stopped him from understanding the local market. In a way, he's been nurturing clients through his architectural practice.
Do you think the Lebanese customers are now really open to design or willing to spend money for it?
Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of, and I can notice that even some of my clients who used to be very much into the 17th century, etc., are coming, but with conviction, to the world of the modern art and design, etc. And I travel with them, I show them pieces, and they see that there are real artists behind it. There are real thoughts, and that can only touch and only provoke things. And they start to compare. I'm not diminishing the past. On the contrary, I think those guys in the 17th modern were modern for their time. They've created proportion, they've created everything. But things has to move on. People has to see that there's progress. We cannot just stall on one period. And this is the beauty. We should always respect the past and always push the adventure of art, etc.
There's no doubt Gattarello wants to showcase the best of Lebanese design across the world. Next March, the popular regional Art Dubai Fair will devote a special area for design. And Gattarello, with a handful of Lebanese designers, will be there.
We are there with the greatest European galleries like Carpenter's Workshop, Cayo, etc. So we have to really position ourselves and we have to really show what we can do. And I think we have the potential and the people to do. It's a great opportunity to show what Beirut is all about, this creative energy that we have.
That was Monocle's Beirut correspondent Carol Korn uncovering Beirut's burgeoning design crowd in episode 6. And what a lovely way to round up our best of Section D. This show was produced by Dawn Trump and our editor was Lolita Laguna. To hear any of these shows in full, you can download the full episode from monocle.com's Timeshift. Have a wonderful holiday period and tune into Monocle 24 on January the 3rd for the very first Section D of 2012, where we'll be getting to grips with design and health. In the meantime, I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.